Welcome back to the program. We sit here today at the epicenter of food and wine, kind of the Hollywood of celebrity chefs. But in the 50s, a time that some would probably like to go back to, there was no cooking channel, there were no foodies, there were only TV dinners, tuna noodle casserole, and the emergence of fast food culture. But then along came Julia Child to change all that. She captivated her television viewers with The French Chef. She would bring fine cuisine into the home of average Americans. She transformed the way the country thought about cooking and eating. She was an early feminist who taught women to take pride in their culinary efforts. And last week, she would have been 100 years old. I had the honor of speaking with Julia several times over the years, the last being in November 2001 at the opening of Copia. Today, to talk about her life and legacy, we're joined by Bob Spitz, who's written a new biography of Julia entitled Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. Bob Spitz is an award-winning author. He wrote the definitive biography of the Beatles, and for years he was in the music business representing the likes of Bruce Springsteen and Elton John. It is my pleasure to welcome Bob Spitz here today to talk about Dearie, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. Bob Spitz, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeff, my pleasure. Happy to be here.
Good to have you here. Julia wanted you to write this biography, even though much had been written about her. What was it that she wanted to capture about herself? What did she want you to say?
I think more than anything, it was her spirit, her independent spirit. She was involved in another biography when I met her. And she called me a few months later, and she said, oh, they're making me sound as if I'm already dead. I think she missed the fact that they didn't really find out who she was, and that you couldn't smell food on the page. So that was my objective when I wrote this book. I wanted you to really have Julia right inside that room with you while you were reading, and I wanted you to smell what she was cooking.
You had spent some time traveling with Julia in Italy. Talk a little about that.
You know, I was in Italy in 1992 working on a few magazine articles. And I got a call from a friend at the Italian Trade Commission who said, I know you have some extra time on your hands. Would you mind being an escort for an older woman? And I thought, you know, that's funny. I don't do that kind of work, lady. She said, is Julia Child? And I said, I will be right over. Julia was 82. Her legs and hips were bothering her. She had always had knee problems because she couldn't carry that weight. And she kind of wanted to tour Sicily, and she wanted a younger person to just hold on to their arm. And lucky me, I was the guy. I got to spend 3.5 weeks doing nothing but eating and talking with Julia. We spent all day together, and we'd have 3 meals a day, and I ran the tape recorder, and we talked about her life and about food and about the importance of eating in the world and in America. It was a wonderful education.
Talk about that and how her attitudes about food had changed and evolved over the years. In the 35 approximate years that she had been really focused on food, talk about what she saw and how she saw it transforming.
Well, in that period, we were in the 90s, and food was really starting to evolve at that point, really changing its shape and its taste. At first, Julia had been befuddled by it. You know, when Nouvelle Cuisine came out, it was the first major change, and Julia didn't take to it. She always felt that there were one too many things on the plate, too many hands had played with the food. But as the 90s evolved, and young chefs really started to step out and put their own stamp on, let's say, American food using tried-and-true French technique, Julia became galvanized by it. She loved these young French chefs. It started, of course, with Alice Waters, and then with younger chefs in California, Jonathan Waxman, people like that. And then her own hometown in Boston, in Cambridge, where there was Jasper White and Jody Adams and Gordon Hammersley, all these young people, French-trained, but doing something completely different. And Julia loved it. She wasn't cooking it, but she sure was going to encourage it. And I think she put all the efforts in the last years of her life into encouraging these young chefs to put their own brand on things.
And it really was the next generation coming along. It was taking all the work that she had done and, to some extent, Americanizing it.
Yes, without a doubt. they were French trained, and almost all those chefs who I had talked to, and I talked to all of them for the book, had used Mastering the Art of French Cooking. They had learned on that. So basically, they were learning on technique that stretched back to Escoffier, and that's where Julia really fell in love with them, because Julia was first and foremost not a cook, but a cooking teacher. She always felt that that would be her legacy as a teacher. And that's what she saw emerging with these chefs, that they had learned their craft. They had mastered. And that gave them license, in her eyes, to go out and change things a little.
What did she see as the fundamental difference between being a cook, a chef, and being a teacher?
Well, you know, I think the difference was that teaching was all about technique, and that you couldn't be a chef or a cook before you learn technique. You know that scene in Julie and Julia, everybody knows it, where she's chopping onions, Meryl Streep's chopping, and Stanley Tucci comes home, and he's blinded by this incredible mountain of onions sitting there. Well, you know, Julia did that. I mean, she would chop hundreds of onions just to get the chop right. That's what she felt you needed to do before you could really cook. So, you know, I think that stretched also into her whole take on what these young culinary so-called rock stars are doing today. And I think Julia would have been appalled by not just their lack of subtlety, but their lack of technique.
As she started doing the show, as her work started to gain in popularity, did she see it as simply proselytizing what she loved and what she believed in, or did she sense it early on as a kind of pushback to the fast food culture which was starting to permeate at the time?
You know, Jeff, I think it was a little bit of both. Julia, first and foremost, wanted to change the way Americans ate. She really was appalled by it. She thought they put really crappy-tasting food in their mouths. When she came back from Europe, she couldn't believe what was being served in the local restaurants. They first came back to Washington, D.C., and then they gravitated up to Cambridge. So she felt that it began in the home, really, not in the restaurants, and that's where the proselytizing came in. She wanted to change the way homemakers, and she never said housewives, it was always homemakers, what they not only fed to their families, but how they felt about what they were doing. She wanted them to kind of step out from behind the stove and take the bows, because if they felt good about what they were doing in the home, then they would also feel good about continuing the experiment, you know, the investigation into making really delicious food for their families. So in that respect, it was the proselytizing. But also, you know, the cherry on top for Julia was that it did change the kind of fast food culture that was prevalent in those days. And it wasn't so much, you know, Big Macs and things like that. But in those days it was, you know, Mrs. Paul's fish sticks and casseroles made with condensed soup and things like that. So I think she achieved both of those goals.
Things were changing in the restaurant world as well. I mean, Craig Claiborne played a significant role in bringing attention to those changes.
Yeah, he did, and I think that Craig and Julia kind of, they were the 1-2 punch. What they really changed in the restaurant world was the culture of the chef being recognized as the star. In those days, nobody knew the chef. When you walked into a French restaurant anywhere in America, the star was in the front of the house. It was either the owner or the maitre d' who greeted you. And the chef was really just some technician in the back who followed the recipes and turned the food out. Nobody knew the names of chefs. And I think Craig and Julia both started to make sure that that changed and made sure that they were recognized for what they were doing back there.
The other aspect is the degree to which her timing was so impeccable. When we think back to the early 60s and Jackie Kennedy and all things French, there was this wave of interest in France and in things French that Julia was able to take advantage of.
Well, she always said that. It was timing. Julia felt lucky. She didn't really feel like she had done so much as she had done it at the right time. Yes, you're right. The Kennedys were in the White House. You know, people started to travel, which they hadn't done before. Travel became a little less expensive. The men who fought overseas brought tales home of how amazing the food was in France, so that people not just traveled, but also went over to Paris to do some eating. And so all of this coalesced at the right time and really gave Julia, you know, so much more ammunition to work with.
Go back and talk a little bit about the way in which Julia kind of fell in love with cooking in general and French cooking in particular as a result of this really one famous lunch that she had.
Absolutely. It can all be traced back to it. And Julia always referred to it, always, her whole life, as that lunch in Rouen. You know, it was the very first day she set foot on French soil. They had just come in on a ship from that landed at Le Havre. And Paul drove directly to this restaurant. He had read about it in a Michelin guide. I think it had one star, maybe two stars at the time. And Julia had never, ever put French food into her mouth. You know, she really hadn't put good food into her mouth. So Paul ordered for her, and he ordered a Dover sole. He wanted her to try something that was just plain delicious. No complications on the plate. And you know, they brought her just a piece of fish on a plate in a pool of molten Normandy butter. Julia put one forkful into her mouth, and you can trace it right to that first bite. Her life changed. She really changed from being Julia McWilliams into Julia Child, the person that we knew right there at that lunch in Rouen, and that did it. By the time they got to Paris, Julia was ready to devour the world.
Beyond that lunch, what influence did Paul have on her attitudes about cooking and food?
Well, Paul Child not only influenced Julia's cooking and food, Paul Child really turned Julia into a modern, sophisticated woman. When she met him, Julia felt she was no more than what she called a social butterfly. She had been a rich, pampered girl, a dilettante, and she had no goal in life. She didn't study much at Smith College, where she graduated. She kind of majored in carousing. So that when she met Paul, he had said he considered her an empty vessel, and he began filling her up, not just with food and things like that, his talk about food, because he had been to Paris, he had eaten that food, but he began talking to her about philosophy, great literature, the arts. He knew people, the Hemingways. He photographed with his buddy Steichen. He knew Gertrude Stein and that crowd. May Sarton was a friend of his. And so Julia just started to, I used the word devouring before, I could use it again, devouring everything Paul put in front of her. And he did. He loaded it onto a plate in front of her, and Julia gobbled it right up. And that empty vessel filled very fastly. Julia became a political animal. She became well-versed in literature. She read philosophy. And more than anything, she started to learn about food from what Paul had taught her. And he kind of, you know, he gave up his life. And he was a terrific artist. I mean, really spectacular to be, you know, Mr. Julia Child. And he was happy doing it.
And arguably that was his artistic creation.
You're right, it was. He was a fabulous painter, unrealized. He was a great stained glass artist, unrealized. He was a really incredible writer. His prose was beautiful, unrealized. But Julia was his work to the world, yeah.
One of the things that's interesting, even though she graduated from Smith, that early on in her relationship with Paul, that there was this real intellectual insecurity that she had.
Well, a lot of that could be traced to her dad. Her father was a prominent Pasadena businessman, and he disdained anything intellectual, which is so odd because, you know, he graduated from Princeton with very good grades, but he resented intellectuals. He resented people who read things, who spoke French. anything that would have been sophisticated. And because of that, he really disdained his son-in-law. He hated Paul Child. He thought he had stolen Julia away. And so that gave Julia the insecurity in the early days. She wanted to please her father, so she didn't want to be too smart. You know, she didn't want to be intellectual in any way. And she struggled with that the entire time that her father was alive.
Talk a little bit about the way she and Paul met. They were both working for Bill Donovan, for the OSS at the time.
Exactly right. Wild Bill Donovan, who was the head of the OSS, who started it. Julia wound up in Southeast Asia, where Paul was. Paul ran something called the War Room, and it was the place where all the generals convened, and he did the dioramas so that they could see troop movements, not just of the Americans, but of the enemy as well. Julia ran what she called the registry, and the registry really diagrammed the and kept a record of the place where all the American spies were. She had given them their code names. She knew their movements. She knew who they were. And so, you know, everybody's always asked me, was Julia a spy? I think it would be safe to say she wasn't, but was she in the spy business? Oh, you bet she was.
Her fearlessness and the experiences that she had early on, talk about how that helped her deal with essentially becoming a celebrity in her own right.
Well, you know, her experiences in the early days were just a kind of, they were spontaneous. I mean, you know, she, of course she was in the OSS, and then she struggled at Cordon Bleu because they sure didn't want a woman there, and more or less an American woman. So she kind of pushed back against everything. You know, she, against number one being a woman, wanting to be successful, wanting to master things. These were all things she had to push back against. And, you know, I recognized right away her not only her struggle, but how her success came out of those struggles. I had written, you know, a book about the Beatles, and this dovetailed completely with the way John Lennon and Paul McCartney brought their craft to the fore as well. They were told what they were doing wasn't what young men should be doing. They had complete belief in themselves. They railed against the forces that said they couldn't do it. The industry was completely beginning at the time. I realized I was writing the same book. You know, these were the same kind of people. And that these kind of people, the people who change our lives, who change the world, are people who have complete belief in themselves and just have an innate sense of what they're doing is right.
A complete belief in themselves, certainly as Julia had, but also the understanding that it was a craft and that the more you did it, the harder you worked at it, the better you would get.
Well, absolutely. And it goes back again to what I said, that word mastering, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Julia believed, and this is one of the things that amazed me so much in my research, that her cookbook would be nothing if the recipes weren't perfect. So she cooked, say, a roast chicken, you know, 50 times. She cooked every kind of chicken. She cooked them, you know, trussed or untrussed, stuffed or unstuffed, on a gas range, on an electric range, a 10-day-old chicken, a 2-day-old chicken. You know, she was just obsessed with getting things right. And that's really one of the most remarkable things about her. She worked on that cookbook for, you know, almost 10 years, putting all of her savings into it without any hope of, at the beginning, of getting any of that back. But, you know, she believed she was doing the right thing. She couldn't be dissuaded from it.
It's the idea of, you know, we talk about today in Blink, the idea of 10,000 hours that she put in.
Oh, easily. And, you know, she and the Beatles, you see it all the way down the line. You put in the time or else, you know, you don't make those things happen.
How did she see in her later years the emergence of a far greater celebrity culture in the food world, particularly among people that didn't practice their craft to the same degree but became celebrities nonetheless?
Well, you know, Julia was very kind to emerging chefs. And I think the one thing that always disturbed her was that there were many who just graduated from some kind of a cooking course or from the Culinary Institute, and 2 days later were opening their own restaurant. And in the book, I wrote a little scene where she and a friend go into a restaurant in Boston, and, you know, it's the hot new restaurant, and she eats the food, and she knows that it's not good. So when they come out to ask her why, what she felt about it, she said, oh, we've had such a good time here tonight. Not we've enjoyed your food, but we had a good time here tonight. And she pulled the chef aside, and she said to him, you know what would really benefit you would be like 2 years in France, really, you know, working with another chef to see how their technique is and how they put things together. And that's how generous she was to young people. But I think that there were so many young chefs that she felt just had their restaurant much too quickly, as opposed to someone like Emeril, who Julia recognized right away had all the technique. He really knew what he was doing. His food was fantastic. He had worked at it a long time. But believe it or not, and I'm sure your listeners won't believe this, she felt he had no personality. So she told him if he was ever going to be on TV, he had to go out and develop a personality. And I guess that's where we got the bam, bam, bam.
And the other part of it is that even though she might have been critical of some of those instant celebrities, it was really Julia that created the merger, more than anyone else, of food and entertainment.
No doubt about it. She was the spark. She lit the spark, and the fireworks came with all those other young chefs. In fact, you know, she was the culinary world's first superstar. First TV star, and, you know, actually she launched PBS in her own way. So, yes, I think she was happy that they were taking food somewhere else, and they were expanding on things and let the chips fall where they may.
How did you feel about the way she became parodied later on Saturday Night Live by Dan Aykroyd?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. Julia never really cared for parodies. Because everybody who did one went straight for the voice. And ironically, Julia didn't think she had a funny voice. But when she saw Dan Aykroyd's, something in it, the darkness of it, really appealed to Julia. She loved it. Someone gave her a video of it, and she showed that video to everyone who visited her for the next 10 years. And then she would reenact it in her kitchen. She would, you know, she would go, save the liver, and she'd fall over dead on her kitchen counter and then crack up laughing. I had the extreme pleasure of talking to Aykroyd about it, and he said that was such a spontaneous piece. Senator Al Franken wrote it and was under the table pumping the blood while he did it. And Dan loved it because his Aunt Helen was considered the Julia Child of Canada, so he felt very close to the whole thing.
What would she most like her legacy to be?
Oh, no doubt about it. Julia Child, cooking teacher. she changed the way we ate because she taught us how to cook. And I think that, more than anything, would be it. She would like to know that people learned how to do things for their own families through her TV show, her books, and everything else, and provide them with delicious, nutritious, well-made food. Even at the end of her life, Julia would have been more pleased by that than anything.
Bob Spitz, the book is Deary, The Remarkable Life of Julia Child. Bob, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Hey, Chef, this was great. Thanks.
Thank you.